Martin Handley for Friday night's live performance on 3, starting at 7 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now 12 midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And today we're repeating an edition of the programme first broadcast in 2001 as a tribute to the writer Alan Sillitoe, who died earlier this year.
A sure qualification for turning into a writer is to grow up with a divided personality. That's a line from Life Without Armour, the autobiography of Alan Sillitoe. Was it very much a divided personality, Alan?
Well, it was divided in the early days because I had this ability to live within the culture absolutely and be seen as a part of it. But at the same time, to have this kind of air of, shall I say, detachment and stand outside and look in and see what it was made of.
Did that help you when you entered the RAF? I think you said actually being the height of your powers at that moment.
Well, I think, yes. When I was about 17, I'd already worked 3 years in a factory, so I considered myself to be a workman. Then at the same time, I had enlisted for the Fleet Air Arm and passed the Aircrew Selection Board as a pilot, which I never expected to do, and I did it. And then I was going to take up a job in air traffic control for about a year before being called up. So I felt absolutely wonderful. It was to do with aviation, and that was my early love.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, because I would have thought in a funny kind of way that starting to be a writer, writing short stories, and then coming up with Saturday Night and Sunday Morning and The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, that could be described as quite a high period, too.
Well, it was, yes. But, I mean, that didn't come for another 10 years.
And the music of your childhood, Alan, what kind of things remind you of that period?
I remember one evening when my parents had gone out, I was fiddling with the radio, and I heard, I think, one of the parts of La Lazienne by Bizet, and I thought that was wonderful. It kind of epitomised my feelings of not belonging and yet not knowing quite where I was going. I think I must have been 13 at the time.
And then there was a figure who became a kind of hero for you, who represented all kinds of things. So it was not just the music, it was the man, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. I think people like Al Jolson, Sophie Tucker, but I think, above all, Paul Robeson. He was the great hero among my friends and to me, really, singing his wonderful songs, especially the Old Man River, as I remember.
There's an old man called Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Old Man River, that Old Man River. He must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters. He don't plant cotton. And damn that planter, is soon forgotten. But Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and wrecked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But Old Man River, white man boss. Show me that stream called the River Jordan. That's the old stream that I longed to cross. Old man river, that old man river, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling. Body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge and lift that bale. We gets a little drunk and we lands in jail. I get weary and sick of crying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying.
Yes, somehow it synthesizes quite a bit of the misery I saw as a child, you see. So it's very nice to hear it even now and again.
And that was somebody who, in a sense, represented other people who were in a downtrodden situation.
Yes, absolutely.
And he did a lot for them. Mm. As a spokesman. Yes. Well, that was Paul Robeson, of course, in the 1928 London production of Showboat and Jerome Kern's Old Man River. Well, you then went, as you mentioned, and very fascinatingly in your autobiography, I must say I enjoyed it very much, into the Air Force. And did you, when you entered, ever think that there was a time when you might see combat?
No, you see, the thing is, the war had ended already. And I did go to Malaya for a couple of years. And during that time, the emergency broke out. But it didn't worry me particularly. I mean, I was staked out at the end of the runway on my own for quite a long time. I had a rifle, I had a Sten gun, and I felt perfectly confident that I could look after myself.
I know that Vaughan Williams represents for you this period of your life in a rather distinct way.
I wasn't really very musically educated at that time. In fact, I don't think I was educated at all. I had no composer, I would have said, I loved. I mean, of course, I knew of Chopin, Beethoven, and so on, because, of course, through the radio, which was wonderful, they couldn't help but make an impression. During the war, a lot of popular music was played. They play Sir Edward German or Lionel Monckton or Coates and so on. But then I do remember Vaughan Williams and this wonderful folk song. One morning I heard it on the radio when I was going out to my work as an air traffic controller, and it made me feel very good somehow. It was wonderful music because, you know, it put a spring in one step. Well, 17 was certainly the highlight of my life. And I don't think I quite got back to myself until I was about 30 when my novel was published.
That was 17 Come Sunday from the English Folk Song Suite by Vaughan Williams, London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. And the interesting thing, Alan Slater, was that you made in your autobiography quite a strong connection between that early writing and a particular piece of music.
Oh, the Berlioz Benvenuto Cellini Overture, yes. What I said in my autobiography was that in May, Majorca, we left the hillside, as it were, where we were living, and went back to a house in the town, taking a flat on the third floor, the rear terrace still giving the panoramic expanse of mountain that we had come to expect. I worked much of that year on Saturday night and Sunday morning, stitching the narrative together by ploughing in a dozen Nottingham stories, which seemed to concern the main character, or to amplify the background before which he performed, some of the stories and sketches having been written as long ago as 5 years. This creative process, if it can be defined as such, was recalled later on seeing Benvenuto Cellini at Covent Garden. In the opera, the all-powerful Pope is waiting impatiently for the statue of Perseus and the Gorgon's head, which he has long since paid for. Visiting the atelier, he threatens the sculptor with hanging if he doesn't produce the work immediately. Cellini finds that he doesn't have enough metal to finish, and to get out of the impasse, rushes around the studio, snatching up smaller pieces already done and feeding them into the furnace. Thus the Perseus appears, welcomed by Pope, workmen, and the artist himself, of course, with great enthusiasm, a dazzling climax to the opera. Saturday night and Sunday morning was constructed after much the same fashion, the Pope in my case being the spectre of poverty should my RAF pension come to an end.
Thank you.
That was the overture to Benvenuto Cellini by Berlioz, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. You were talking, Alan Cilento, of a sort of comparison in construction there. And do you find that with music, that there are connections with literature, or do you think that it's a spurious argument on the whole, that it's very, very removed? I mean, do you think about music in terms of writing and poetry?
I suppose I shouldn't say this, but I do often listen to music, or at least I put it on, and it's in the background when I'm writing. I remember writing a complete novel called A Start in Life, and all the time I was repeating Handel's Messiah, and it somehow inspired me to go on writing this long novel, which incidentally I started as a short story, but it went on for 500 pages, so of course I had to call it a novel. But I do have this feeling for music. It's somehow, what can I say, it shines away into the soul, or almost into the subconscious. So it's very, very encouraging to hear it when you're writing. And also, regarding symphonies, I mean, sometimes a novel can be such a complicated, complex structure that you can only liken it, in a sense, to a symphony by breaking it down into certain movements. And this very much helps you to assemble your raw material when you come to write the second or third or fourth draft, to see its shape. And you simply can only liken it to a kind of symphony, not, of course, a real symphony, but it has some kind of depth to it if you can achieve that.
The next music we're going to hear, I think, is prompted by life abroad, wasn't it?
Yes, we left England, Ruth Fainlight and myself, on January the 10th, 1952, intending to stay in France for about 6 months. And in fact, we didn't get back for 6 years, in 1958. And during most of that time, we were living in Majorca. And of course, we read George Sand's famous book, A Winter in Majorca. And we were very friendly with Robert Graves. And we visited Valldemossa, of course, where Chopin and George Sand had their cells, as it were. And I'd heard that, of course, I don't know whether it's confirmed, but many people say that he did compose this following piece there. There was so much rain. I mean, the Majorcan winters are really not all that good, you see. They're wonderful in the summer if you can stand the heat. But in the winter, there is quite a lot of rain, and the poor chap with tuberculosis, sitting in this dreary cell, he composed this piece of music.
That was the prelude in D-flat, opus 28, number 15, by Chopin, played by Arthur Rubinstein in a recording made in 1946. How did you feel being away from England as much? I mean, was there a part of you that consciously wanted to leave England?
Well, I think that ever since I was sort of 5 and 6, I wanted to leave England. And the first opportunity, of course, came with the Air Force, and then we were able, on my RAF pension, because I had something to do with tuberculosis after service in Malaya, I don't know, and they gave me 100% disability pension, so I was pensioned off at 21. And we went, as I said, to France and Spain. I think there was a great advantage, because apart from being able to learn French and Spanish, it was very good to look backwards onto the place you came from and see it in its entirety, rather than the little details which would rather cloud the mind. And it was like looking back at it through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars, and very useful to me. We worked on our poems, novels, and so on. I think I must have written about 6 or 7 books, which were never published, thank God. And every quarter, Her Majesty sent me a cheque. And you could say that during all of my 20s, I was living off a woman, you see, which was very good for me, because I was enabled to become a writer. What seemed like an absolute disaster on being told I had TB, in fact, turned out to be something very, very unique, because I had this patronage from Her Majesty for 10 years, during which I wrote my books. I gave Robert Graves one of my early novels, one of those novels about expatriate people or something that I was writing in Majorca. And he said, yeah, you know how to tell a story, but why don't you write a novel set in Nottingham? And I thought, what the hell does he know? You know, you never take advice from older people. But at the same time, I had been writing many short stories set in Nottingham, and one or two had been published. And so a year or so later, I did indeed sit down under an orange tree and start writing something called The Adventures of Arthur Seton, which by the third draft had taken on the title Saturday Night and Sunday Morning.
Your next music, Alan Solito, again comes from travels to Moscow this time.
Oh, yes, this is Prokofiev from the ballet Romeo and Juliet. I was in Moscow, and I'd spent a day going around museums and art galleries and so on, and by the evening I was absolutely done for, but they said, we have tickets for you to the Bolshoi. So I thought, oh, God, I'm just going to go there and sit there, and I'm going to go to sleep. Well, I said, well, what's on? And they said, Romeo and Juliet, Prokofiev. I remember, in fact, I didn't go to sleep. I was absolutely electrified by the music, and especially by the section, The Death of Mercutio.
Death of Mercutio from Romeo and Juliet. The Bolshoi Theatre Orchestra was conducted by Gennady Rozhdestvensky. Prokofiev's extraordinary score. It's one of the most brilliant scores for a ballet, I think, that exists, don't you, Alan?
Well, I'm glad that I recognised that it was. I think it was obvious, you know, one couldn't mistake it. It was something quite different. I hadn't heard it up to then.
I mean, if you sat through ballet as I have and often been entranced by the dancing but just bored rigid by some of the scores, and then you would come across this or Tchaikovsky or Stravinsky, it's like, you know, the lights all come on suddenly.
Well, you get the feeling that Prokofiev understood and loved Shakespeare as much as Berlioz.
We're staying in Russia for more music, except that it was out of Finland, as you might say.
I went on a tour of Finland. I was taken by Finnair all around Finland on a 10-day holiday, and all I had to do was write a 4,000-word article for their in-flight magazine. And when I came back from our country house, I had a 4-pound slab of smoked reindeer meat and two bottles of Finnish vodka.
Which is a drink you are partial to.
Which I'm very, very partial to it. And I remember we invited our neighbours to have supper that night. And we sat there over the meal and we sliced off pieces of smoked reindeer meat and drank vodka. And in the background, well, not in the background, it really dominated everything. We played The Execution of Stepan Razin by Shostakovich.
We'll be right back. Kind of massiveness to the music, as in the words, isn't there? The Yevtushenko's words.
Wonderful, yes, very great lyrics as well.
That's the execution of Stepan Razin by Shostakovich. That was music near the opening. The bass was Vitaly Gromadsky with the RSFSR Russian Chorus and the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Kondrashin. You said something quite amusing to me, Alan, before we did the programme. You referred to Gogol's overcoat.
There is the common saying in about 19th century Russian literature, in fact Russian writers said it among themselves, that all the great writers, Turgenev, Dostoevsky, Shkredin, etc., they all came out of Gogol's overcoat. It set the tone. It was a kind of tuning fork for the whole of the century for Russian writing, for great, great Russian writing.
And that in a way, our next piece did the same for a certain period of opera.
Well, it's always seemed so to me. With Bellini's Norma, one can see Verdi, Puccini, etc. All the great Berlioz as well, everyone, they all sort of came out of Norma. It has such wonderful tunes, wonderful drama, and it's full of feeling. It's a great opera because of this woman, this priestess in love with a Roman legionary who has his children. And there's this split in their relationship which can never be reconciled, and it ends in a tragic, in an extremely tragic way. My favourite singer, of course, taking the part of Norma, is Callas. She does such a wonderful, thrilling job of that part.
Thank you.
Maria Callas as Norma with the chorus and orchestra of La Scala Milan, conducted by Tullio Serafin, Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma. She certainly does get an extraordinary dramatic quality into the voice, into each phrase, doesn't she, there?
It's complete, really. I don't see how anyone can really draw anything more out of it. I often remark to myself how absolutely extraordinarily lucky everyone is that great music is now so accessible.
You mentioned earlier, Alan Sillitoe, that The Messiah had been very much an inspiration and a companion to one of your novels. But it's another piece of Handel that we're going to finish with, isn't it?
All my life I've been, I shan't say enamoured, but the Bible, the King James version of the Bible, is one of my favourite books because I love the English. I love to read it. I sometimes read a chapter a night simply to cleanse my mind of the of what's gone through it during the day, especially if I'm concerned with my own writing. But the great cadences from the Old Testament. And I found that Handel, in, for example, Israel in Egypt, he had an arranger, of course, a librettist, but they were pretty much paraphrased from the King James Version. And I heard it once in Israel, in Jerusalem, and it had a terrific reception and a very good effect.
And the aria you've chosen?
Well, I mean, it's all really, in a sense, one great chorus after another.
Yes.
And I think, say, Sing Ye to the Lord, the final chorus from Israel in Egypt.
Thank you.
Sing Ye to the Lord, the final chorus from Handel's Israel in Egypt. Elizabeth Prideay was the soprano at the beginning of the chorus, and we heard the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra conducted by Sir John Eliot Gardner. What are you writing about at the moment, Alan? Are you working on a novel or short stories? Or
I've just handed in a novel. Strangely enough, it's set completely in Nottingham, and in one way it is a sequel, or not a sequel, let's call it a continuation or further explanation of Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, which I wrote 40 years ago. I've taken up the characters in wondering where are they now, what happened to them, what are they doing. But it also centres around a new female character. It's, again, as I said earlier, shaped in something like a symphony. I've had this consciously in mind and I only hope it works. But it's called Birthday.
Well, I enormously look forward to reading that. But meanwhile, Alan Sillitoe, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Michael Barclay was talking to Alan Sillitoe, who died earlier this year. That programme was first broadcast in May 2001. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest is the opera director Graham Vick. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3.
In rural Spain,
the work's going well, and we have no children to waste money on.
We have no children.
A childless woman yearns for a baby.
Men have another life, their flocks, their orchards, their conversations. Women only have their children and caring for their children.
A yearning that becomes an obsession.
I thought I heard a child crying.
Yes.
Close by.
Federico García Lorca's play, Yerma.
If I could shout, I would rouse the whole village so they could see what's become of my family honour, but I have to choke it back and keep quiet because you are my wife.
Drama on 3, tonight at 8.
That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's just after 1 o'clock. Time for the news now, read by John Shea.
The new leader of the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, has insisted he will be his own man and denied claims that he will be in the pocket of the trade unions whose support helped secure his victory. He was speaking after beating his elder brother David by just 1.3% of the vote. In a BBC interview this morning, Ed Miliband denied that his leadership represented a lurch to the left. Palestinian and Israeli negotiators are trying to find a way to keep peace talks going despite the ending of a partial freeze on settlement building in the West Bank. The 10-month moratorium is due to expire later today, threatening to undermine a fresh impetus in the process. This morning, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu urged Jewish settlers to act with restraint. The Spanish government has rejected a statement from the Basque separatist group ETA that its ceasefire will be permanent and verifiable. In an interview with a Basque newspaper, two ETA representatives said the group was willing to take further steps towards a negotiated end to its violent campaign for independence. More than 800 people have been killed in ETA's campaign of shootings and bombings, which began more than 50 years ago. The Indian government has warned that the village for athletes competing in the Commonwealth Games won't be finished until Wednesday, 4 days before the opening ceremony. Despite this, the Welsh and Scottish teams have now moved into their accommodation in Delhi. There's concern for a British woman living in Hong Kong who's been missing in the Philippines for 2 weeks. Carol Day was making a regular business trip to Manila, but has not been heard from since September the 12th. The Philippines government has made the search for her a high priority. And the weather. It'll stay fine in the northwest, the north and west of the country. The southeast will be cloudier with showers over East Anglia and Kent. Overnight, the rain will spread to many central and eastern areas, but become light. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at almost 3 minutes past one.
And that was John Shea. I'm Jill Anderson. Good afternoon to you. In an hour's time, Chichi Nwanuku will be here with Radio 3 Requests. And we'll be hearing works by Michael Haydn, Otto Olsen and Ethel Smythe. And the guest requester is the tenor Ian Bostridge. But now, the Early Music Show with highlights from this year's York Early Music Festival. And today, Catherine Bott focuses on music for a Renaissance Jewish wedding.
Thank you.
The lovely bride steps slowly and gracefully through the room, dressed in white silk and red velvet, with pearls and ribbons threaded through her hair. Her wedding singers offer advice. Lady, see your husband often. Serve him well, be he old, young, or just a boy. Soon she will be joined by her handsome bridegroom, and they will stand under the ritual canopy, the chuppa, to be married. In today's early music show, an evocation of a Jewish wedding in Renaissance Italy, carefully researched and lovingly performed by Ensemble Lucidarium in a concert given as part of the 2010 York Early Music Festival. In a few minutes, the wedding itself, from the arrival of the groom to the revelry after the ceremony, with only very brief scene painting from me. So let's begin by putting the event into context. It wouldn't have been anything out of the ordinary for a 16th century Italian Jew to have cousins who spoke German, an aunt who'd married a Spanish refugee, or in-laws who came from a different Italian city, all of them bringing their own customs and liturgical melodies. During rehearsals, I asked Avery Gosfield, co-director of Ensemble Lucidarium, to confirm that Italian Jews were Europe's oldest ethnic minority.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they came to Rome with the Romans. Actually, before the fall of the Second Temple, they lived in pre-Christian Rome. So it really is Europe's oldest ethnic minority.
So this Jewish wedding that you are recreating, not literally, but in atmosphere, is it something that Italian Jewish people would recognize now?
Well, certain melodies are taken directly from the Italian liturgy. And if you'll hear them, you really couldn't say when they're from, because they've been retained in the tradition. The tunes to the liturgy are written down, as in the case of Gregorian chant, and really kind of set in stone. The words stay the same, but the melodies change from place to place. And Italy was actually a bit insane for this, because often every town had its liturgy. And as a matter of fact, in a case like Venice, you had four different synagogues. You had the Italian synagogue, you had the German synagogue, you had the Spanish synagogue, and you had the Levantine, the Eastern synagogue. And every synagogue in Venice had a different tune for their liturgy. And then, you know, you have to multiply this by all of the communities, Gorizia, Rome, Pitigliano, Florence. And we drew on this extremely rich material. And also the piyut, which are Hebrew poems, which are non-liturgical, but they're often linked to celebrations, either during the liturgical year or for celebrations of the life cycle, like a wedding.
Avery Gosfield of Ensemble Lucidarium, who plays pipe and tabba and recorder. She was joined for this performance in the Sir Jack Lyons Concert Hall of York University by seven colleagues, singers and instrumentalists, who between them played fiddle, recorders, lute and guitar, hammer dulcimer and percussion. Together they brought all the ritual elements of a Renaissance Jewish wedding to life, drawing on both Sephardic and Ashkenazi traditions, music of several different countries and languages including Hebrew and Yiddish, Spanish, Italian and English. Before we become members of the wedding, there's one more thing to tell you. A vital part of this performance was played by the two dancers who represented the bride and groom, the historical dance specialists Bruna Gondoni and Marco Bendoni.
There were a lot of Jewish dance masters during the Renaissance, so the dance element is very important in the Jewish context. And we're also very, very fortunate to have two of the leading experts in historical dance with us, Bruna Gondoni and Marco Bendoni, who basically work with every early music group in Europe. They're also extremely open, so that when we presented them with this project, they were happy to have the challenge of miming the bride and groom or perhaps improvising. For example, you can't see it on the radio, but the bride's arrival is improvised using historical steps. And it's very nice also because as we improvise on historical models, so do they.
Avery Gosfield, So now let's join the wedding party. The bride has arrived, and it's time for the entrance of the groom, as he strides in doublet and hose, with short cape and a red velvet hat. His friends tell him, "You should love your wife, feed her, clothe her, and don't be stingy when it comes to her honour."